Explicit content is found in this episode. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club Podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. In the small town of Bald Knob, Arkansas, in 1995, two brutal murders and sexual attacks shook the community. These crimes were committed by three different men. One of them was later found to be a serial killer. Okay, on to the show. On June 6, 1995, at Automated Tax and Accounting Services in Bald Knob, Mary Phillips was working when her oldest daughter, Daria, dropped off her younger daughter, Lacey. Lacey had a dentist appointment that afternoon at around 3 o'clock p.m., and then Mary and Lacey were going to return home around 4:30 or 5 o'clock p.m. However, they never returned home. Darla contacted James, her father, who was 500 miles away on a business trip, to let him know that their mother and little sister Lacey had not returned home. James asked Darla to see if her mother's car had been broken down close to home, then told her to stay indoors and wait for her to return. Around 11 p.m., James received a call saying he needed to return home because something had happened. James packed his bags, called his supervisor, and began the drive home. Their children had contacted the local police department to let them know their mother had not returned home, and the police found her vehicle at the tax service. They contacted someone with a key, and around 3:30 a.m. were able to make entry into the building. Police found Mary Phillips' body, nude from the waist down. The Criminal Investigation Division of the White County Sheriff's Office was contacted, and Detective Bill Lindsay responded to the scene, which was taped off and closed until investigators could arrive. J.R. Howard from the Arkansas State Police was also notified. Detective Lindsay discovered Mary with a cord from a Mr. Coffee Pot around her neck and wire around her hands. She had defensive wounds on her arms and back, indicating she had put up a fight with her attacker. She also had blunt force trauma to her head. During the later autopsy, they discovered she had also been sodomized. As investigators continued to photograph the scene, they noticed blood coming from under the door of the bathroom and opened it to find 11-year-old Lacey tied to a chair. They believed she was also dead and began photographing her body. Just as Detective Lindsay took a photograph of her face, Lacey opened her eyes. She was flown by helicopter to Arkansas Children's Hospital in Little Rock, approximately 60 miles south of Bald Knob. Lacey had also been choked and was beaten severely. She had been hit with a BB gun so hard in the head that the gun stock had shattered, and she had severe skull lacerations. Despite her severe injuries, she was able to give the investigators information about their assailant. Lacey recalled a tattoo around his eye, which immediately sparked a recollection with Bald Knob police officers. The suspect they had in mind was Jack Jones. Lacey told the officers that she asked the man not to hurt her mother, and he replied, quote, "I'm not. I'm going to hurt you." Jones had earlier painted a sign outside the tax service, then went into the business claiming he wanted to borrow a book. He came back a short while later, telling Mary and Lacey that he was sorry because he was going to have to rob them. He made Lacey lay down on top of Mary while he robbed them, then took them to a break room. He then separated them and began his horrendous assault. Arkansas State Police investigator Jerry Brogdon went to Jerry's house around midday on June 7, 1995, and asked Jack Jones if he would accompany them to the White County Sheriff's Office. Jones agreed and, once at the sheriff's office, was read his rights and signed a waiver of said rights. He confessed to the crimes and admitted that he had committed these crimes because his wife had been raped, but the police had done nothing about it. He wanted to get revenge against the police. Jack Jones was born on August 10, 1964, in Toledo, Ohio. His sister, Lynn Scott, said they were close, although she and other family members stated that on Jones's first birthday, he suffered a high fever and convulsions. He was later diagnosed with attention deficit disorder and given Ritalin. The Ritalin likely caused the hallucinations of bugs and spiders that he later suffered from. Jones would often bang his head against cupboards. In 1989, he attempted suicide, and again in 1991 when he jumped off a bridge. Just months before he murdered Mary Phillips, he was admitted to Pinnacle Point, a psychiatric hospital in Little Rock, Arkansas, due to the severe depression and suicidal thoughts he was experiencing. At this time, he was diagnosed as bipolar and prescribed lithium. Jones had started taking drugs at an early age, beginning with marijuana. At the time of Mary's murder, he was using methamphetamine. Jack had suffered from physical abuse from his father and sexual abuse from three strangers who abducted him and then raped him. But the record is not clear on what age this occurred. Jack Jones was charged with capital murder in the death of Mary Phillips and attempted murder in the assault and attempted murder on Lacey Phillips. He awaited his trial at the jail in White County, where incoming and outgoing mail had to be read. During one such task, one of the jailers intercepted mail that described a plot for Jones to escape the state hospital while he was there for his mental evaluation. The letter was to his wife, and the jailer immediately turned it over to her supervisor, who advised Detective Lindsay. The jailer was interviewed by J.R. Howard, and Jones ended up being even more closely guarded during his mental evaluation. Jack was sentenced to death on April 17, 1996, after a jury took only 30 minutes to return a guilty verdict. His defense attorneys only called one witness, a physician whose license had been surrendered due to alcohol and drug abuse, and who left Jones's chart in his car the morning he testified. Chris Raff was the prosecutor on the case, and he had already successfully prosecuted three death penalty cases. Jones was transported to the Varner Unit, where Arkansas male death row inmates are housed. It is located south of Pine Bluff and is adjacent to the actual death chamber. Female death row inmates in Arkansas are held in the McPherson Unit in Newport, Arkansas. Jones filed the normal appeals, the main one being that the state should not have been allowed to show graphic photographs of Lacey during his trial. One of these pictures showed Lacey's exposed skull. The appeal was denied. While Jack sat on death row, a cold case in Florida was getting colder and colder. Lorraine Ann Barrett, 32 at the time, was from rural Pennsylvania. She had traveled to Fort Lauderdale on May 31, 1991. Her mother had reservations about Lorraine going alone, but her daughter assured her, saying, quote, "Don't worry, Mom. I'm going to lie on the beach and have a good time." Lorraine arrived in Fort Lauderdale and checked into her Days Inn room at around 9:30 a.m. She contacted her friend, Laura Lacey, who lived in the area, to let her know that she had arrived and that she was meeting a friend at Coconuts. The friend never showed, and so Lorraine ended up meeting a man at a bar called the Elbow Room. Laura said that she and Lorraine were very close. Laura, who had some health issues, said that Lorraine was very special and helped her by always being there for her. Laura was planning on hosting a cookout for Lorraine while she was in Fort Lauderdale. Detective Tom Mangifesta said that the man Lorraine met was soft-spoken and friendly. Other patrons in the bar described his tattoos and that he claimed he got them in various parts of the world. Lorraine and the man left the bar, then returned a short time later before heading to the Days Inn bar. Around 2 a.m., they were seen getting into the elevator together, which was the last time anyone saw Lorraine alive. Lorraine was found around 11:30 a.m. on June 1, 1991. She had been raped and strangled less than 5 hours after being in Fort Lauderdale. A composite sketch of the man was issued, and his many tattoos were described and included in his description, particularly the barbed wire on his wrists, along with the hearts with names on them. In 2003, Fort Lauderdale police detective John Curcio was informed that there had been a hit on a national DNA database in the Lorraine Barrett case. The sample matched that of Jack Jones. The composite and tattoo information also matched that of Jones. Curcio contacted Lorraine's father, John, to give him the good news. John then called Lorraine's sister, Roberta, at work to let her know the good news as well. She issued a statement to the papers saying, quote, "It's the news you always wanted to hear and always hoped to hear, but to hear it from out of the blue, it was overwhelming because it was so unexpected." Police served a fugitive warrant to Jones at Varner, which started the process to bring him back to Florida to face the charges of first-degree murder and sexual battery. In April 2005, Jack pleaded guilty to first-degree murder in the Lorraine Barrett murder case. In exchange for this guilty plea, the judge waived the death penalty, and he was given life without parole for her death. Florida authorities obtained special permission from Governor Mike Huckabee to fly Jack Jones to Florida to stand trial. He was held at the Broward County Jail. I'm going to pause the case right here so you can hear a word from our sponsor. Jones continued to appeal his convictions on various points. While he awaited an execution date and word from his appeals, he was contacted by Gina Grimm. Gina was his biological daughter who had been put up for adoption at birth. She had been curious as to who her biological parents were, and when she turned 18, she went to court to have her birth certificate released. She found out who her father was, then began researching what she could about him. She was, of course, somewhat shocked about his crimes. She realized she had been blessed and had lived a somewhat sheltered life, but she also realized how lucky she was to have her adoptive parents. However, she did want Jones to know she was doing well and that his decision to put her up for adoption was the right one. The two struck up a correspondence, and she quickly had boxes of letters from him and paintings he had made for her two children. However, before Gina could meet her biological father face to face, Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson ordered the execution of 8 inmates before the state's store of midazolam expired. This is one of 3 drugs used by the state when conducting lethal injections. The drug would expire on April 30, 2017. So the executions would have to take place before then. The executions would occur in pairs between April 17th and April 27th. Jack was set to die on April 24th, along with Marcel Williams. The weekend before Jones was set to die, Gina Grimm contacted anti-death penalty activists Scott Langley and Randy Garner to ask if they would be covering James's execution on Facebook Live. She explained who she was, and they arranged for her to fly into Little Rock to meet Jones face-to-face for the first time. The state of Arkansas does not allow family members of the executed to witness the execution, so Gina and Jones' sister, Lynn, had to stand outside the prison as the execution took place. Jack Jones was served a last meal of 3 pieces of fried chicken, potato logs with tartar sauce, 3 Butterfingers, a chocolate shake with Butterfinger pieces, and fruit punch. Due to Jones's size and health problems, it took officials 45 minutes to insert a central line to administer the life-ending drugs, which many death penalty critics claim is unethical because only medical professionals should insert a central line. Jack Jones was pronounced dead at 7:20 p.m. It was said it took 14 minutes for him to die. Some media witnesses reported that Jones was gasping for air after his last words, so this one Marcel Williams, slated to die before midnight that night, a last-minute, temporary stay of execution. However, it was later determined that Jack was talking to the Department of Corrections director, Wendy Kelly, after the microphone had switched off. Jones was thanking Kelly for being so nice and was apologizing to her. Jack Jones's last words were addressed to the Phillips family. He said, quote, "Well, I just want to let the Phillips family and Lacey know how sorry I am. I can't believe I did something to her. I tried to be respectful from the time I took and become a better person. I hope I did better. I hope over time you could learn who I really am and know that I'm not a monster. There was a reason why those things happened that day. I am so sorry, Lacey. Try to understand. I love you like my child." He also wrote a statement for his attorneys to read. "I want people to know that when I came to prison, I made up my mind that I would be a better person when I left than when I came in. I had no doubt in my mind that I would make every effort to do this. I'd like to think that I've accomplished this. There are no words that could fully express my remorse for the pain I caused." In 2007, Jack had given his sister Lynn a letter and explained to her not to open it until 1 year after his execution. He had told Detective Curcio of Fort Lauderdale that he had murdered one other woman and that he would reveal this after his death. In the letter, he instructs his sister to contact John Mongo Curcio, who will know who to contact. His sister upheld his wishes and in 2018 opened the letter. She presented the letter to the proper authorities. And in February 2019, DNA testing confirmed that Jack Jones was a confirmed murderer in a 36-year-old case that another man had pled no contest to and had been sentenced to 50 years. The letter to Lynn exhorts her not to make the revelation of this additional murder into a circus. He does not want to cause additional pain to her family after all these years and says, quote, "If and when, I want you to let these people know I had you do this, that I wanted them to know. It's one thing to learn that their daughter's killer has finally been brought to justice one way or the other. But it's more so of a closure instance when the information came about peacefully, without resistance, so that peace is added to peace, rather than adding to a measure or element of negativity." Jones also says in the letter that the woman he murdered, Regina, haunted him for 3 years. After confirmation of the DNA, the Broward County State's Attorney's Office asked the judge to toss out Stewart's murder conviction based on the DNA evidence that Jack Jones committed the crime. Although Stewart had passed away in 2008 from cancer while still in prison, the state's attorney's office and the Hollywood Police Department agreed that it was only appropriate that the record must be set straight. On May 2, 1983, Regina Harrison, 20 years old, was last seen alive when she left her parents' house to go for an evening bike ride to Hollywood, Florida's North Beach. Regina was found the next day in the secluded woods of Hollywood's Westlake Park. She was nude and had been strangled. Her bicycle was found nearby with her clothes neatly folded. The autopsy revealed she had been sexually assaulted and strangled. Regina Harrison had returned home 3 days before her murder for summer vacation. She was attending Palm Beach Atlantic College in West Palm Beach, Florida. Regina was a well-liked South Broward High School graduate who grew up in Dania. Her friends and teachers said she was mild-mannered, cheerful and trusting, and an outstanding student who liked to talk with others about her Christian faith. Her brother said that his sister was extremely kind and would have found a job in a profession to help others. After Regina's body was found, a jogger recalled seeing her on her bike around 6:42 p.m. alongside a man on a bicycle. They were casually chatting as they rode in the area of Scott Street and the boardwalk, heading north toward Sheridan Street. An arrest was not made in the case for several months until the jogger picked out a photograph of Ronald Stewart in October 1983, when Fort Lauderdale police sent his photograph to the Hollywood police. Ronald Stewart was a parking valet and serial rapist who had been convicted in 2 states. Stewart had been serving time in Mississippi, where he had also previously been convicted of burglaries and served 3 years of a 9-year sentence. He was paroled December 1982 for those charges. Ronald Henry Stewart was sentenced by Broward Circuit Judge Barry Stone to 50 years in prison to be served concurrently with a 50-year term imposed in 1983 for several Fort Lauderdale rapes. Stewart pleaded no contest to second-degree rape. Stewart's murder sentence coincided with the previous rape sentences, but the additional finding of guilt in the murder case would extend his possibility of parole. Allegedly, Stewart confessed to a fellow Florida inmate who said that Stewart told him he had been riding bikes with a girl, then choked her to death. Richard Harrison, Regina's brother, said the family was shocked to learn that Stewart had not committed the crime, but were relieved that the killer had been brought to justice. Richard said that Stewart never denied the crime, even when appearing before the parole board in Mississippi. Chris Raff, the prosecutor who convicted him of Mary Phillips' murder, said at the time of Jack Jones's trial, he had not known of the other murders, but the brutality of Mary's murder convinced him that Jones would kill again if ever given the chance. Investigators in Florida and other locations are comparing Jack Jones's DNA to several unsolved crimes. According to the letter written to his sister, he had moved from Florida back to Ohio. So Florida, Ohio, and Arkansas are potential states that he could have committed murder in. As a side note from Susie, who researched and wrote this episode, she has a very compelling experience that she'd like to share, and I'm going to read what she submitted. I worked in the jail when Jack Jones was an inmate, awaiting sentencing. In fact, we had 10 murderers at one time in our jail. I think this was a record for White County. Jack was housed under suicide watch for the entire time he was there, but in retrospect, this was probably done more for his own protection from the general population, based on the brutality of his crimes against Lacey, more so than his suicidal tendencies. Although, I'm not sure those existed. I worked predominantly 911 while working there, but also worked in the jail at times. When working in the jail, I often had to take Jack to and from meetings with clergy or his attorneys or to the activity yard. I was never frightened to do any of this on my own. Jack was actually a very charming individual with a sense of humor who would always speak to me or joke with me when I walked past him. It's sad that he had mental issues and his family did not get him assistance in his youth. Knowing someone who was executed was weird because it made me think more about the death penalty than I had before. I feel for the victims and their families, but also for Jack's family, who has also been left to deal with this. Okay, fan club members, as I conclude this episode, my one question to you is, how will you sleep tonight? Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to leave us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or your podcast player of choice. It really does help us out. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCpod, Facebook.com/TCFCpodcast, Instagram TCFC_podcast, and of course, our website is TrueCrimeFanClub.com. If you have an episode request, send us an email, TCFCpod@gmail.com. Music for the show and audio engineering was provided by Nico at We Talk of Dreams. You can follow him on Twitter at We Talk of Dreams or check out his website, WeTalkOfDreams.com. Content warning at the top of the show was provided by Tyler Allen, host of the Minds of Madness podcast.